Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And, you know, Middle Eastern food has been getting, especially Lebanese, has been getting quite a lot of play lately. But I'd say Mediterranean food is always in style.
Yeah, and it's been around for a long time.
Yeah, and I think we'll be talking to several people to get an idea of what kinds of products you can get and what kind of styles of eating you can expect in Rome and other kinds of tidbits.
All kinds of things.
It's a tidbit show.
From that corner of the globe. But they're Mediterranean and Levantine tidbits.
Tidbits.
And what more appetizing thing can you start off with than a book entitled Rosewater?
Rosewater and Orange Blossoms.
Here goes.
This is the food that I love, I have to admit. Maureen Aboud has written a book called Rosewater and Orange Blossoms, which is her heritage, Lebanese. And it's all the food I love, Maureen, and I just drool reading through here.
Thank you.
And funny thing is, you actually grew up in Michigan, and the book said you never went to Lebanon until several years ago?
That's right. I grew up in Michigan, where there is a large population of Middle Easterns and Lebanese in particular. So even though I didn't travel to Lebanon until a few years ago, I grew up very much with the culture and the traditions being passed on from our large Lebanese-American community.
Now, why are they in Michigan?
I think many came early in the last part of the last century for jobs in the auto industry.
Okay, that's
so you have a lot of Arab Americans in the Detroit area and suburbs, and then in Lansing, lots of Lebanese, and primarily these are Christian Lebanese. Most of the immigrants leaving the country and most of the Lebanese you'll meet in the U.S. are Christian.
And they're leaving as something to do with the fact that they're Christians and the other guys don't like them.
Bingo.
I kind of thought
the last century, yes, that is what happened.
You have all the wonderful recipes, and you also have all these little stories about your family that you intertwine throughout the book. And I mean, I was fascinated picking up, like, was it your grandmother had an arranged marriage? She got married to somebody she didn't want to get married to. She had to come immediately to the U.S., which she didn't want to go to. And what was the other thing?
I'm glad that you mentioned that, because these stories have really been endlessly fascinating to me and inspiring, and I've wanted to learn more about them and to understand what my grandparents' experience, what their experience was like. And that particular grandmother, she, in my mind's eye, had a lot of strength and courage to come here and not speaking the language with someone she did not know, who happened to be her husband. And so this was a different era, a different time, a different way of living that is part of my history. So I want to know more about it. And then I see, as the generations have assimilated and grown here in the U.S., our way of life is so much different, you know, in terms of our complete dedication to education and opening as many doors as possible for second and third generations to be able to do whatever they want to do and, of course, marry whoever they want to marry or never get married if they don't want to get married.
Now Maureen, let's just pause a second and can you explain a little bit of the ethnicity of Lebanon? I mean, Lebanon is sort of squeezed between Syria and Turkey and much closer than it would like to be to Israel and the Gaza Strip. I mean, what makes Lebanese different than those other peoples?
Well, Lebanon has long been a highly cultured place with very cosmopolitan people from all over the Middle East and Europe coming through Lebanon has influenced and impacted Lebanese culture a great deal. Lebanon was a protectorate of France for many years.
Okay, I thought that for a second. I thought there was some French influence there.
There really is. Many of the Lebanese, in fact, most of my relatives who immigrated spoke not just Arabic, but French as well, and English. And you see it in the cuisine somewhat, too. You know, it's not one of the favorite things that I had when I visited Lebanon for the first time and was staying in the hotel there was croissant with the classic Lebanese za'atar spice in it.
Oh, yeah.
So to me, that was the perfect fusion of Lebanese and French culture.
That's amazing. Well, now you have notes about special ingredients, and that's useful. I was most particularly interested in, can you help me? I adore chickpeas, and my farmer's market now has fresh ones.
Oh.
I cannot ever figure out how to easily prepare them. I mean, I've tried everything. Everybody has a tip. You know, you dry roast them, and then the peels are supposed to just come off, and they don't. And it takes hours.
Yes. The whole idea of the peeled chickpea for us devotees of a very smooth and ultra-delicious hummus is a labor of love to peel the chickpeas. And there are shortcuts that you can try to take, like one of the methods that I write about in the book is to use a little bit of baking soda. But what I've sourced, and I'm so excited about it, is a chickpea that's already peeled.
you can get those at Whole Foods. They're flash frozen, like frozen peas.
Okay, but the garbanzo bean?
No, they're real chickpeas.
Well, okay. They're garbanzos.
Yeah, they're garbanzos too, I guess.
Oh, okay. So the pre-peeled chickpea makes life a whole lot easier.
Yeah, I know. I was so excited to see fresh chickpeas in this farmer's market.
Well, I'm interested in that too because I really haven't seen a whole lot of them around where I'm living. And I was out in California about 2 weeks ago, and a friend of mine gave me a little bag of them. And I honestly don't know that I've seen the fresh chickpeas before.
Well, they're the most bizarre-looking things.
Yeah,
the seed enclosure looks like a real rat's nest.
I mean,
it's like a horrible great pile of ugly twigs going in all kinds of different directions. doesn't look the least bit appetizing. But we notice you like Frika
and freaks out over Frika. Yeah, I love
the
Frika.
Green wheat. Don't you just love the texture? It's a little bit chewy. It's got a little bit more to it. And then health-wise, it has more to it as well. And I love my recipe for the Frika with chickpeas and tomato.
Oh, yes.
And this is such a homey, simple dish, but really healthy and easy to pull together. And it has really nice Lebanese flavors in it.
Yeah, we interviewed, how many years? It must have been 6 years ago. The guy who
a crazy Australian.
An Australian guy who
was making Frika in South Australia. At least he said he was.
Trying to, and I'm surprised it hasn't caught on more than it has, because it's certainly good. Yeah.
It seems like it will, and I think all the grains that the Lebanese use, they do it really well, and I love the grains chapter in the book, because it's just, shows how versatile and delicious these grains can be in legumes.
But you don't like lentils, you wicked lady.
Well, that was the little girl Maureen.
Okay, that was the little girl Maureen.
The grown-up Maureen really loves them now that I understand them better and have a palate for them. And our mujaddara, which I'm sure you've had, is just becoming more and more popular. And I'm excited to see that because mujaddara it's lentils with deeply, deeply caramelized onion, and you can use bulgur wheat, coarse-grade bulgur wheat, or rice, and you've got just the perfect protein here. I mean, it's really a healthy dish.
Now, here's one for you. It's called equal parts of sprouted lentils, sprouted quinoa, and sprouted mung beans.
Whoa.
And Anne has that for breakfast with soft-boiled eggs every morning.
No kidding?
Yeah,
You are one healthy lady.
I don't feel healthy.
I make a supply that lasts about 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, we can't keep it that long. We figured out. The other thing, by the way, I was really grateful for you to tackle is I hate that people torture pomegranates. What is difficult about just getting the seeds out? Why do you have to beat them with a wooden spoon or put them over a bowl and peel them under water? I've never seen anything like how they go on about this. There are videos on my homepage and all kinds of stuff. I think Food and Wine does it. I mean, it's not that hard.
It's almost as though the pomegranate has the cut marks already ready for us. You know, it has its lobes, and you just follow those lobes with your sharp knife, and then you pull it apart, and you've got these beautiful chunks of pomegranate, and once you remove some of that membrane, there you have those gorgeous gemstone pomegranate seeds ready to eat.
I keep a bowl of them when it's in season, and just in the refrigerator, and if I want a snack, I just eat them.
You know, you already have them cut up?
Yeah, I have them already in a bowl, and they stay forever, so.
That's the way to do it, isn't it? So then every time you want one, you don't have to go and cut your pomegranate.
Yeah, and particularly, again, this farmer's market always has these specials, and there are only two of us, but sometimes I get, you know, like 5 pomegranates for $2.
Oh, my goodness. That is a deal.
Then we turn purple after about 3 weeks. We turn purple.
So, and also, my favorite spice of all times is za'atar.
And me both.
Yeah, and we have some really wonderful local organic lamb growers, and one of them, I don't know if you've heard of Jamison Farms. He's very wonderful. Well, anyhow, he was visiting, and he brought some meat with him, which is a really nice hostess present.
And
what he chose, we were going to grill it out. What he chose to season it was za'atar.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So. Just delicious. And the za'atar, of course, is that blend that has the wild thyme, Lebanese wild thyme.
Yeah, which is special, isn't it?
Special, yes. I have my own za'atar spice blend that I'm selling now on my site because I love the balance of flavors. And it includes that sumac, which is a very citrusy, almost lemony flavor, which I think pairs really well with lamb. I can see why that was very delicious.
And well, where do you get your wild thyme?
I import it from Lebanon.
Oh, do you?
Well, now, let's make sure we get this in. You mentioned the website, and is that maureenaboud.com?
At maureenaboud.com, you can go to the shop button and head over to Maureen Aboud Market, which is also at maureenaboud.com or maureenaboudmarket.com. And there you will find my very, really wonderful select ingredients like imported Lebanese olive oil, my za'atar spice blend, kibbeh spice blend, and, of course, the peeled chickpeas.
So you are selling them after all.
Yes. Just one recipe after another in this book is just, I mean, irresistible, like, I'm looking at warm dates with almonds and lime zest.
That's
fabulous.
You've got great taste. That is really one of my favorites in the book because it is addictive. The dates are very caramel-like in their flavor, and you stuff it. You take the pit out and stuff the date with a toasted almond or roasted salted almond and just ever so lightly saute it in some olive oil. And finish it with lime zest and some sea salt. And it couldn't be simpler, yet it's very elegant. And everyone who tastes this just swoons over it.
Oh, I mean, everything in this book is to be swooned over. It's just, I just opened here. I had a question. I told Peter that we had kibbeh all the time. But you need a butcher to be able to do that. I mean, to take the time to do that. What
you need
do?
Either a very good butcher. You cannot, for kibbeh, which is a blend of kibbeh naya, which is eaten raw, a blend of ground lamb or beef with bulgur wheat and pureed onion and kibbeh spices, that meat does not just come from the meat counter, go and grab some hamburger meat. No way.
No, see, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I used to have a butcher who would do that for me. He would go through and pick out all the sinuous stuff, and you know, but I don't have anybody like that anymore.
Oh, and that is one of the pleasures of living in mid-Michigan, where you can go into the grocery store and say, I'll have a pound of kibbeh meat, and they know exactly what it is, and they have to grind it. First thing, you know, you can do it at home, too. It's a little bit of your own labor of love there to do it, but to trim out the meat perfectly so there, as you say, there's no fat or sinew, and then grind it at home. I know many people who would only eat it raw if they ground it themselves.
Well, that's very sensible. At least, at least if you die, you committed suicide.
Yeah.
Nobody else is to blame.
Well,
but
I mean,
of course,
you bet. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that while the kibbeh made with meat is the most classical and most traditional dish of Lebanon, I love all of these other vegetarian kibbeh recipes that just take it in another direction. Tomato kibbeh and potato kibbeh. These are all really neat recipes too.
Now let's before we close, let's put in a plug for Lebanese wine, which was a revelation to us when we were at this restaurant I was telling you about earlier, Al Waha in London. Of course, we had wines from Lebanon, and they were really quite excellent.
They were excellent. They were.
And it's
surprisingly,
it's the sort of thing that sort of might be viewed as a bit of a joke if you didn't know better.
Yes, and the whole Bekaa Valley of Lebanon is such a fertile region. And I did visit some wineries there when I visited Lebanon. And what beautiful wine country it is. And we're just tasting very complex, delicious wines that could compete with any around the world, from Kassara and Messiah, and they're just wonderful wines.
Of course, you've got the French influence there. I guess that probably has a lot to do with it anyway.
Yes, right, and yes.
But
I'm sure that they've learned.
The terroir,
oh, sure. Anyway, this is...
Well, before we close,
you can also drink rose water, I guess.
I just wanted to let you put in a word about why this book is called Rose Water and Orange Blossoms, which just the title of it makes you want to dive in.
Oh, thank you. Really evocative flavorings in the Lebanese cuisine are these flower waters, rose water and orange blossom water. They're fragrant, they're aromatic, and they're unique to our culture and cuisine, and I just love them. And they have inspired me I also feel that these flavorings and their titles draw us into this cuisine in a way that might be enticing to someone who may not have had it before and want to know more about it.
Well, this is a really a revolutionary book. I don't mean revolutionary, revelatory. Is that the word I meant?
Probably. And Maureen Abood's a great spokesperson.
And you are.
Are you on the payroll?
I'd like to be.
seems to me,
do such a wonderful job.
It seems to me like you've earned it.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yes, let's talk soon. I wish you could cook for me.
I would love to.
I'll try some of this, though. Maureen, thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you both so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
And we'll be back with an interesting track about products from Greece right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I personally want to thank our next guest, Viviana Karamanis, for doing what she's doing with the love and passion she brings to it. She's locating small producers in Greece that would not have the means to arrange to have their products brought to the United States and promoted and so forth. And the products are excellent, and I'm so happy she's doing it.
And the Greek government should print a medal just for her.
Yeah, and her company's called Hellenic Farms, and she's going to tell us all about it. For many reasons, I think, just sheer quality and deliciousness, and romance also, Greek food seems to be hitting a high point. We were trying to discuss this with Viviana Karamanis. Welcome to On the Menu, Viviana.
Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah. You were explaining why this is, because you've noticed it too. In preparation for the Fancy Food Show, we've gotten endless emails from various types of Greek specialty food companies. And you say you have too. Let's put out front that your business is Hellenic Farms. And you'll explain that to us. But first, explain to our listeners your theory on why all of a sudden we have such high-profile Greek products.
So my theory is that a lot of people are basically going back to their roots. And what I mean by that is they've inherited lands from their great-grandparents and grandparents, their fathers, mothers. And this land supplies agriculture. There's olive trees, and there's just all these different things that they can use and take advantage of this land to produce. So I think this young generation of people are going back because there's just no work for them in this economy.
Right.
And they're going back to their roots and they're saying, you know what, I have this. It basically cost me nothing. And I'm going to package it in a beautiful bottle and tell the story, because there is a story. Greece has, whether it's something simple like an olive or a bee, there is a history to it. That's what our country has. And I think that's what people are doing, is sharing this through agriculture.
Well, it's very interesting. And I love the concept of your company. Now, did you dream this up?
I come from a family of foodies. My father is an immigrant who came here following his heart for my mother, and he's in the seafood distribution industry. But my grandparents own the only bodega on the small village that they're from in Chios. So I've always been around food. No, I didn't dream this up. I actually was a TV producer, and I followed my heart to Greece because I fell in love with someone there. And it always has to do with drama and romance.
It does, doesn't it?
In Greece, or anything that's Greek. And so I realized that there was all these brands that didn't really have an opportunity or a chance to leave Greece or, you know, the European countries near Greece. And they were so beautiful, and they were just grabbing all my attention. And so I started reaching out to producers and suppliers and asking them, you know, what are you doing with these products? Are you selling in the U.S., or where are you selling? And literally every single one of them pretty much said the same thing, that, no, we really want to sell in the U.S. That would be our dream. But they just kept facing rejection.
Well, it's not easy. In fact, no one from a Greek background has told us this, but people from other countries in Europe have said it's really very difficult to get approval to import an agricultural product into the United States because of all the U.S. Department of Agriculture's regulations. And quite a number of people have said, we understand that the only way we're going to be really successful is if we actually contract and make the product in the U.S. Now, is this something that you're coming across as well, or have you found a magic way?
You're right. And a lot of companies have done that. Like, you know, the most famous thing that's Greek right now is Greek yogurt. And I feel like Faye was sort of forced to do that. They had to open a facility here to be able to compete with the pricing of all the other Greek yogurt brands that were out there, or Greek-style yogurt brands. It's not something that people have asked us to do it. A lot of buyers and mentors and people that we've spoken to seeking, because we've faced a lot of rejection, and our biggest, complaint is that our prices of our products are not competitive. They're too pricey. And the truth is, the solution to that is, bringing bulk here and packaging it here. But that's not what we believe in. You know, this company, Hellenic Farms, was born during the crisis of Greece. So to take away work from Greece and Greek people is not something that we will ever do.
No, you know, okay. We interviewed the guy from Phi, when he first started Greece.
Yeah.
He was in Athens.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I understand your point of view entirely.
And I agree with you too.
I guess you just do it. You do it and 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 you don't take no for an answer.
Exactly. And we'll keep doing it and we'll keep doing it and people will keep tasting the products and they'll be blown away by it and then they'll understand why it's okay to spend $2 or $3 more on, you know, our marmalade over another one.
And they'll we're at the point where we should really, for our listeners' sake, explain what is this your business model here, and who do you represent? Because their stories are really interesting too.
Yes. So we're importers and suppliers of really amazing brands that are all Greek. We represent about almost 10 brands at the moment that we exclusively import into this country. And what makes each brand so special is that they all really have their own story to tell. You taste these products, which in most cases, the ingredients of these products are super simple. You know, the one that we were nominated for a Sophie, it's a sesame seed bar.
Oh,
it literally has two ingredients, sesame seeds and honey. That is it.
I worked at a museum in the Midwest for a while, and I used to have, they make little ones of those, little candies of those, and I used to have a jar, and people would have in their jars, you know, on their desk, hard candy. I always had those sesame things.
Yeah. They're amazing.
Oh, they are.
And they're really healthy for you, and they're an energy booster, and there's a whole history behind it, and it's just so simple and yet unique. So we have met with all of these producers, with all of these suppliers, and we sat down, and we wanted to hear each and every story. Because bringing over olive oil and bringing over sesame seed bar, it's not something new. We're not doing something that someone hasn't already done.
Mm-hmm.
It's just we're bringing it over with the actual story to tell.
So we have a nice box of things to sample. And a lot of them were from this country, the company that I, the producer that I noticed when I went on your website anyhow, because it seemed so interesting, was Navarino.
Yes.
Tell
Navarino
us that
icons.
Story. Yeah.
So, Navarino icons, I mean, in general, Navarino is, it's a bay in Greece, that's very famous in history because it was the, there was a battle won there that granted Greece's independence from the Ottoman Empire.
Oh, wow.
But more so, a very, very wealthy and successful shipping company in Greece, whose captain and founder had built this resort, is from this area of Messenia, and he built this resort called Costa Navarino. And ironically, the key factor to the Messenian economy is Costa Navarino. This man, this company, offers so much work in that area. And he went from this resort to also this brand of products, this food product line. And what they do and what they did and what they continue to do is they basically gathered all of these locals who are taking local traditional recipes and, you know, we've been enjoying them for all our lives, whether it was our grandmother or our mothers who were making them, but they decided to take it one step further and package it and share it with the rest of the world.
Uh-huh.
And that's what Navarino Icons does. Each product of Navarino Icons has a story to tell. Each product, you know, the vegetables, they're locally grown. Everything is hand-picked. The recipes are local. Even, I'm sure you've noticed on some of the packaging, you'll see that sterling silver evil eye charm.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, that's actually put there by hand.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So there's, like, a lot of love and work and just us wanting to share that with everyone else.
Right. The crushed eggplant dip is to die for, by the way.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with the tomato and pepper dip. I wouldn't even call it a dip. I call it a sauce. And it's just amazing. I mean, there's a positive and a negative. You open it, and the truth is you need to eat it right away because there's no preservatives that are going to you know, keep that, or you're not going to be able to really keep it on your shelf for more than a week or more than a month, the most, you know. But it's like, it doesn't matter, because the second you open it, you're pretty much done with half the, if not the whole jar already.
Right.
Now, what's your penetration been like into the U.S. market? How has that been going?
So this is our, you know, it's brand by brand. Our first brand was Five Olive Oil, that beautifully packaged olive oil that I believe I sent you guys. So each brand, we've basically been open for about 2 years, 2.5 years as a company. But Five Olive Oil was one of the first brands that we took on. And then, for example, Navarino Icons, we have only been brought them less than a year.
Okay.
It's hard, Peter. It's been challenging.
Sure. Are you targeting places like Whole Foods, or are you targeting smaller shops?
In the beginning, we target smaller shops. And the reason why we did that is because we, with all the shops that we distribute to or we supply to, we offer them samples with our products. And what we've noticed is the smaller shop and the small shopkeeper will take his time to tell his customer, oh, you have to try this.
Oh,
and they'll take their time to actually learn the story behind each product. And it really helps our products sell much better. Are we targeting Whole Foods? That would be a dream for us, to have one of our olive oils or our olives in Whole Foods. We've been speaking with them about some of our products, and it's just sort of a waiting game. But for small people like us, whether it's us as an importer or our suppliers, you know, well, the challenges that we face is the promotional support that big markets and big chains ask from us.
Now, one thing that we have noticed in the last 10 years and even more in the last 5 is the huge increase in the quality of Greek wines that are making their way into the United States. Is this a market you've left alone deliberately, or are you going to get around to that in due course?
No, it's funny. It's on my number, it's number one on my priority list. I've known about Greek wine, especially wine from Santorini. It's just amazing. You know what? I think that everyone sort of has beat me to it, to be very honest.
It seems that all the
big importers and distributors have already gone and sort of marked their territory.
We get invited to that thing in New York all the time, by new wines of Greece.
Yes.
Yeah.
There was one, it was last week.
Well,
right.
And they've been doing it for several years, Dawson. But they sent, now I have tasted some wonderful Greek wines, especially compared to when I was like a student and I was in Greece, and you know, and it was awful stuff, terrible stuff. But the samples they sent, New Wines of Greece sent these samples, they were awful. We had how many bottles of this stuff? I didn't think we'd ever get through it.
No.
It was awful.
So there is a distinct difference in quality.
Yeah.
And this is a challenge. No, I just wondered if that this is obviously, I'm not surprised it's on your list. I'm also not surprised that it's a challenge too.
Yeah, it's on my list. It is a challenge. It's a big challenge for me. But the thing with us, and again, it's our goal, is that we're looking for a boutique winery. We're not looking for the two big companies that, you know, have basically almost monopolized the Greek wine market. We want to find a small, like, family winery.
Sure, absolutely. That would fit with the whole concept that you have.
Right.
Have you found anything positive or negative affecting your business and people's reaction to Greek product as a result of the really rather, it seems almost foolhardy policies of the newly elected government there? I mean, is that something that affects you, or do you just sort of ignore it?
I completely ignore it. I think that the new government is, it's just a joke. Like, I don't take them at all seriously. I don't think they respect themselves or any other government. And that is proven just simply by the way they present themselves and their attire of what they wear. So, no, I don't take it serious. I don't take it all seriously. And I think that, unfortunately, the Greek politics and the Greek government, it's so volatile. Like, you just never know. You know, they can overthrow them tomorrow. Right. You know,
it's almost as much drama and fun as the Italian government.
So here's how we conclude our conversation. What is it? What is the Greek for keep on trucking?
Yeah, that's actually, I think that's the Greek motto. The next person who runs for prime minister, that's what they should put on their marketing, because it's just that, you know, whether we as a country have hit rock bottom so many times, but if you were to go now as a tourist has never gone, you wouldn't see what you expect to see, what the media portrays Greece
right.
as. So there's this beauty to the country, to the people.
I love Greece.
Yeah.
I absolutely adore it. Yeah.
We'll always succeed. We'll always be Greek.
Got it. And in the meantime, Hellenic Farms will be waving that white and blue flag.
Yes, we will, and you will see two of them at our booth at the Fancy Food Show.
Great.
Yes,
well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today, and we wish you well on this great mission that you have undertaken.
Oh, I really wish you good luck with this.
Thank you guys so thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate that.
My heart's there.
Oh, thank you. I hope you guys enjoyed the stuff
Yes, we're still going through it, but we
okay,
certainly
good.
Do. I love Greek food, period. Anyhow. So, okay, Viviana Karamanis, anybody interested can look up your website, which is?
HellenicFarms.com. It's right. HellenicFarms.com.
Great. And you'll find so many things to choose from, listeners. And good luck with the business, and have fun at the show.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you, Peter, so much.
Viviana.
Bye. Have a good one. Take care.
A forest or police.
It's funny, so give up.
Ciao.
Yes, yeah.
There you go, my dear, gabbling away in Greece, in Greek. And who knows what the future will be for the Greek economy, but it sure seems like companies like Hellenic Farms will have a chance to help. And it's a great story. And great, not only that, it's delicious to eat as well.
It is indeed.
And we've got another fascinating track from this corner of the globe right after the break, so don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
If you are in any doubt that the British are brave, and we're brave too, I guess, it would be that someone would write a book all about Italians and trying to explain why they are the way they are, why they think the way they do, why they eat the way they do, why they govern their country the way they do. But John Hooper, who's been 20 plus years at least, a correspondent for my favorite newspaper, The Economist, and a number of other places too.
The Guardian.
Yeah, decided he would take that on.
He also did The Spaniard, so.
Right.
First.
Well, yeah, but I don't know why we never talked to him about the Spaniards, but we did talk to
about the Italians.
And a very fascinating story it turned out to be.
We're so fortunate to be able to talk to John Hooper. I don't know you in person, but I really intend to be able to sit down and have an espresso with you and talk about all the stuff you've done, which has been plenty. You are the Italy correspondent of The Economist and also the Southern European editor of The Guardian and The Observer, The Economist, we've been subscribers for a long time, is probably our favorite magazine, and everything gets done right there, which I'm very impressed with. You've written two books that are outstanding and well-recognized. The one is first start with the Spaniards, and then the New Spaniards, and now also the Italians, which is what we're going to be talking about. How long have you lived in Rome, John Hooper?
Well, I was based here in the 1990s for 5 years, but I was traveling around a lot. I was based here, but traveling to various parts of the Mediterranean. Then I was posted to Berlin, and fate brought me back to here in 2003. So I've been back now for 12 years. So altogether, yeah, it's about 16, 17 years that I've either been based here or living here.
Well, I mean, I think it'd be hard for you to go back to London. We just got back from London, actually, and it rained every day. Which is not surprising. But anyhow, a lot of the observations in your book, The Italians, individually, I've noted because I went to school there, I've studied there, I've been there a lot, and so has Peter. We go once or twice every year, but never was it put together in such a total picture as you have it. And that, I think, is the genius of this book.
That's very nice to hear. I'm delighted because quite a lot of work went into devising the structure of the book. I spent hours tracing notes on bits of paper and seeing where the lines led. And gradually the structure emerged, and I've tried to make it as easy and as pleasant but informative a read as it could possibly be. There's plenty of facts in there, there's plenty of figures in there, but I hope that it keeps people turning the pages.
Well, I'm enjoying the whole book, but what our program is really about is the Italians in terms of their culinary scene, their food, their construct around the family meal, all of this thing, these things, and you do a very nice job of presenting that, and it makes you understand why, even in the area of food, Italians are so conservative.
Yes, there is a well-worn tradition that recipes are passed down within families. So that it doesn't really matter how other people do it. You know, this is the way it's done in that family. And that does make for a conservatism, but it also means that people don't mess around with recipes. You know, once they've found a good way to do things, then they stick with it. And one of the things I notice very much going out of Italy is how often unsympathetic things are put together, you know, in what's intended to be a creative way, but actually just doesn't in the end taste very good.
Like what?
So, taking a recipe that could work if it were kept simple and putting in, I don't know, oregano or olives or whatever, and just making that slight difference, or adding another ingredient unnecessarily. That is something I notice in America. I notice it increasingly in Britain as well, that, you know, you've got a lovely piece of fish, for example, and what you need to have with it is a relatively mild, say, cheese sauce, but then some shrimps right in on the top, you know, and then there's some crab as well. By the end, you've got a dish that's just too rich. And I think that that is one of the great talents, if you like, one of the great pluses of Italian food, is they stick to the principle of keeping it simple. And it's that that really allows the ingredients, the strength of the ingredients, the character of the ingredients, to come through and impress themselves on you as the diner.
This is true. I mean, this is one of the glories of the Italian plate, is the simplicity of the restaurants and the quality of the ingredients. But it also, it turns out, like, traditions, you outline traditions that are really strange. What was it on Thursday's gnocchi?
One of my chapters is actually called Gnocchi on Thursdays, because I gradually became aware, living in Rome, that every Thursday you saw gnocchi on the menu, and you didn't see it any other day, or then any other day. And if you tried to eat something else on Thursday at lunchtime, people looked at you a bit askance. And I've never been able to find a single Roman who understands why this happens, and yet everybody does it. And to step out and say, no, actually, I fancy pasta, you often see that the waiters or waitresses are a bit disappointed with this, you know, you're doing the wrong thing. And I think it's very much all of a part with a social conservatism that you find in Italy that has, as I say, the positive side is that it's preserved many traditions and it's preserved the integrity, if you like, of Italian gastronomy. But at the same time, in recent years, it has acted as a drag on the country's economic progress because things are continuing to be done in the same way. So, for example, yeah, shops just don't open at lunchtime. Even in Rome, you know, quite important big shops are shut for, you know, 2.5, 3, or even 3.5 hours in the middle of the day. So there's that, I think it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, no, I mean, we happen to know certain chefs in Italy that were almost destroyed by this conservatism, but these chefs have become, well, the one that comes to mind is Massimo Bottura in Modena, and his restaurant just hit number 2, and I was kind of hoping for number 1 on the world's 50 best restaurants, but his story was such that now he's adored because he's made such an international reputation, but they almost destroyed him and put him out of business or drove him out on a rail.
Yeah, I can believe that, and I know
he's experimental in his cooking style.
Yeah, I mean, I know of many cases of that in other walks of life as well. Now, people are very reluctant to experiment on the whole in Italy, and it does mean that, as I say, you keep that purity of the cooking, but you don't get the experimentation of development. There's a wonderful little vignette in a cookbook by Claudia Roden, I think it is, where she is doing something in a slightly different way to the way that it's done in that particular part of the country, and there is a woman watching her do this, and she prepares the dish, and at the end of it, the woman, all she has to say is, "Noi non lo facciamo così." We don't do it like that. And that's it. That's the end of it. That's the end of the argument. And so, yeah, you know, if you want to have it cooked that way, will you go to that town in wherever it is, Molise, Puglia, what have you? But if you want it maybe done another way because you're living there and you're getting maybe a little bit bored of that way of doing it, well, tough luck. It's not going to happen. I think one of the most encouraging developments in recent years has been the development of the arrival, if you like, of particularly as young people coming back from abroad, bringing new ideas in, daring to put a pinch of curry powder in something or just do something in a different way. The one of the things I mention in the book is the way that when you go into an Italian bar, there are certain standard combinations for sandwiches. And they're all delicious, but they're always the same. Just recently in Rome, which is a very conservative city, more conservative, I would say, than Milan or even Naples in its own way, I have noticed one or two establishments setting up and daring, you know, to put maybe anchovies with brie or something like, I don't know, just some kind of little bit of experimentation that is probably illegal, but actually can produce some very nice things. We haven't sort of got to jello and peanut butter now, but
watch out. But, well, no, I mean, you explain why, it's a long story, so I'm sure you can't really abbreviate the whole thing, but why Italy is so conservative as opposed to like Spain. But it really has to do with external pressures, right?
Sorry, I didn't quite catch
I said you explain in your book why Italy is so conservative as opposed to, for example, Spain.
Yeah, I think that has been remarkable in the last few decades. I think it has a lot to do with the fact that Spain went through a dictatorship. And when they look back, what they see is something they don't like. Whereas Italians, when they look back, they see the golden years of the economic miracle, the Dolce Vita, all of that. And so there's a much greater tendency to look back with affection, with nostalgia, and to want to hang on to what that period gave them. And it produces many good things, but actually, what I think people forget in Italy is that, in fact, the things have always been changing. And many of the recipes, for example, that now are regarded as being traditional, were actually introduced in the post-war era. Penne alla vodka, for example, is anything but Italian.
Right.
In nature. Spaghetti carbonara, for example. It seems to have come in with the immediate post-war years in which the U.S. troops brought over powdered egg and bacon, and Italians, not having those things in their own culinary repertoire, didn't know what to do with them, and invented spaghetti alla carbonara in Rome in the late 1940s.
That's great. That's a great story. There were many misconceptions, I think, in many ways. You just sort of referred to some startling facts about what we consider to be quintessentially Italian. And I'm sure there are plenty more, and you've probably had plenty of time to observe them over the years in Rome. Can you give us a few other examples of what people view as quintessentially Italian, which things that are not?
Well, of course, the one thing that we do think about in terms of Italian cooking is the tomato. But that comes from the New World, and for many, many years, Italians were deeply suspicious of the tomato. They didn't incorporate it into their cooking easily. And up until the last century, 20th century, there were parts of Italy in which a different use was made of a grape-based, sour grape-based potion. And that was used to give that kind of acid taste to some of the sauces. At the same time, pasta itself was localized for many centuries. There were parts of Italy where you ate polenta or rice as your staple, not pasta, which seems to originate in the south. It was incorporated into the gastronomic canon of Genoa, but it was missing from many other parts of the peninsula. So things have changed, things have evolved over the years. Other things have remained exactly the same, and cookbooks written back in the late Middle Ages, early modern period show, for example, that Marzolino cheese was popular even then, and that's not changed at all. Parmesan goes back a long way. And other things, too. The other things change over time, even though they might keep the same name. I mentioned the wine of Orvieto, which for centuries was a sweet white wine and is now changing with different tastes.
Well, the thing I always like to point out is that the Romans adored snails and farmed them. And you think of snails. I mean, the English called the French snail eaters or frog eaters. I can't remember which.
Frog eaters.
But the Italians,
in fact, in,
there's a place actually in Carrasco, which has the main study center for snails in the world.
Yeah, and it that too has changed over time because, you know, I suppose modern urban tastes gradually take over in a city. Things like snails seem to be very rustic, very exotic in a way. So actually you don't find them on ordinary menus so
right.
much. But then you go out of the country, and yes, you do very much find that and many other exotic products. The Romans you mentioned, I mean, the ancient Romans, liked to eat dormice.
Oh, no.
Dormice? That still is a delicacy in some parts of Calabria. It's, I believe, illegal, but they are still eaten.
What's the difference between a dormouse and a mouse and a rat?
The dormouse is the hibernating one that you find on the edges of fields particularly. But it is a rodent and is apparently very succulent.
Well, you haven't tried them, John, I understand.
I have not.
Well, you know, we were in Peru, and the national dish is a guinea pig.
Yeah, so it's not that bizarre.
Well, listen, you've had a very busy day, I happen to know, and I wish we could grill you on what exactly you learned today in the week, but that should be another time. And it was great talking to you, and enjoy eating Rome.
Thank you, and likewise.
So we hope you enjoyed this week's program and that you'll join us again same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.